As counsel for the second case gets settled, I'll just give a few preliminary remarks. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's arguments are being live streamed. We're also making an audio recording of the argument, which should be available on the court's website in about 24 hours. That is the only recording permitted without express permission from the court. Counsel for respondents, are you dividing time or is one person presenting the argument?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. Mr. Luder, I'm Mary Hahn. David Ludescher represents Gregory Langer. We had assumed we each had 15 minutes because it was separate cases that were consolidated. However, if that is not, we would prefer that, but if that is not possible and if that cannot be done, we have discussed that I would take 10 minutes and Mr. Ludescher would take 5, and we will talk fast.
Yes, it's 15 minutes for respondents, so a division of time of 10 minutes and 5 minutes works well for the court. Thank you. The podium does adjust up and down for your comfort, and I would ask each counsel before you begin your argument to identify your name and the party that you represent. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Your Honor, do you know how I adjust the desk?
There's
here?
A little up and down buttons, I believe, on your right side underneath there, just under the...
I think it's on the front.
I see it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Perfect. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Mark Allseits, Allseits, and I represent Appellant Greenvale Township. We're before the court this morning on an appeal of two district court orders, one order being an order granting summary judgment request or motion of the respondent, and also an order denying appellant's motion to compel discovery. I would first like to start with the order granting summary judgment in this matter. Before delving into the substance, I think it's important to have a question of law as to whether the motion was premature, thereby rendering the contents contained within that motion an irrelevant question, as the motion itself was premature. This court unequivocally held in Lye v. Harpstead, that's 16 Northwest 3rd, 788 at 802, the Chief Justice held just 6 months ago in her ruling that it is only upon the issuance of an alternative writ of mandamus that a defendant may move to answer or move to dismiss. Mandamus actions are a little bit unique. In this case, appellant had its petition before the court, but the court had not yet made a determination on the sufficiency of the petition and prematurely considered a motion for summary judgment prior to the close of pleadings. And the reason that mandamus is a bit unique also comes from the Lye v. Harpstead case. It is the petition and the alternative writ taken together that constitute the complaint in a mandamus action, something that had not yet occurred due to the court's failure to determine the sufficiency of the petition.
Is it true, counsel, that the township didn't ask the court to issue the writ?
I would disagree with that for two reasons, Your Honor. The first reason would be the prayer for relief itself contains that request, including the petition in name. It is petitioning for the writ of mandamus itself. The second reason is we make the clear request of the court in our response to respondent's motion for summary judgment, informing the court that the next proper step would be to issue the writ. I would also point you to the McFarland and Keppel Civil Practice Guide, something Ms. Hahn holds out as the Bible of Civil Practice, which indicates upon the petition of the writ, if it's facially sufficient, that the writ shall issue if it makes a prima facie showing. We have made that prima facie showing, and I can delve into that a little bit if the court would like. It mainly turns on the Chanhassen chiropractic case, which establishes a 3-pronged standing test for mandamus actions. Remember, Lye says that in mandamus actions, in the notice pleading standard, we don't need technical facts. We only need broad brush allegations. So the question before this court is, does the petitions put before the district court have enough facial sufficient allegations in them to warrant the issuance of the writ? And appellant believes the answer is clearly yes. So going on to this idea.
Follow up with that.
Of course.
From a procedural, it sounds like more of a procedural argument that you're making. So from a procedural argument related to harmless error, what would have happened differently at this stage? Isn't it true if the writ's issued and the response to it and you had some period of discovery that did occur, and then there'd be a summary judgment motion? What would have happened differently to get to where we're at right now anyway?
Nothing, Your Honor. The writ should still issue.
That's why I'm asking, would that then be a harmless procedural error if it was an error?
No, it's not harmless at all, Your Honor, because those motions to dismiss are subject as well to the notice pleading standard. The district court never applied that standard in the first place, which is the problem. They treated this as a motion for summary judgment evaluating a factual record. Prior to the close of the pleading stage, there was no factual record ever developed as the pleadings had not closed. The petition was not paired with an alternative writ to constitute the complaint. And to provide a bit of clarity, Your Honor, I would also point you to Rule 12.03 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. This is a motion for judgment on the pleadings. It is distinct, I understand, from summary judgment, but it, in its rule, it says it is a predecessor to a motion for summary judgment. And even it indicates in the rule that a motion prior to the close of the pleadings is improper. You don't get to bring it before then, and that's exactly what happened. So we didn't get to put witnesses on a stand at a show cause hearing. We didn't get discovery. That's something that Ms. Hahn even concedes in her briefing. If we did get the alternative writ to issue, discovery would then follow. She concedes that. And so those are all of the harms that were suffered, is we never got to proceed with the evidence here because of the district court's failure to issue the alternative writ.
Where in lie does it say that only on the issuance of the writ can the opposing party move for summary judgment or to dismiss?
Page 802, I believe the exact language, if I'm not mistaken, is upon the issuance of the alternative writ. That would be, I think, a direct quotation. I do not have the full case in front of me. I would be happy to provide that direct quotation in reply.
But I guess the word that's doing the work there in your argument is only upon the issuance of the writ. I mean, this wasn't precisely the issue in Lye v. Harpstead, right? There was a dispositive motion made before the writ issued. So I'm just wondering what you're hanging your hat on to say it's only upon the issue.
Your Honor, if I may, it's even if you remove the word only, the Lye case holds that it is after the issuance of the writ that you are entitled to make such a motion. Again, think about this logically. If the pleadings have not closed yet, and the standard that Lye applies is the notice pleading standard, Lye itself says that there is no preference for technical facts at this stage. Broad brush allegations are sufficient. The Lye case also says, with respect to any motion to dismiss, that the notice pleading standard still applies, and the standard is only if the petitioner is able to have the possibility to present evidence consistent with the theory that entitles it to relief. And again, if the question is just the possibility of being able to present evidence that entitles it to relief, the writ should have issued pursuant to the notice pleading standard, and any contemplation of fact is wrong. It is premature. And I would also say,
You did engage in some discovery in this case, right? I mean, you moved to compel, so it wasn't as though no discovery was had because a writ hadn't issued, right? I mean, there was a record on which the district court based its summary judgment decision, a record of discovery.
A limited record, Your Honor. I would say that the discovery was not properly complied with, hence the motion to compel. I would also indicate that the factual record was not fully developed, as we are entitled under Chapter 586 to a show cause hearing at which we can present further evidence. Also, we believe that we were entitled to discovery via the joint discovery plan that was signed by the parties on January 4th of 2024. It was a binding stipulation of the parties, which pursuant to Rule 29 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure supersedes the rules for timing and nature of discovery. I'm sure a substantive part of the briefing that you read was whether or not that discovery request was premature. Counsel had treated it as such. They turned over no documents to us as a part of discovery, so that discovery was not fruitful by any means, and the court didn't consider the evidence it should have that we were entitled to via the joint discovery plan, the stipulation, and Rule 29 of discovery.
So I guess that's that last part of your argument is pretty critical. Does the joint discovery plan amount to an entitlement to certain discovery? I mean, don't you get a court order through a motion to compel to establish entitlement to certain discovery? I mean, I think it seems like you're conflating a joint discovery plan with a stipulation between the parties that all of these documents that you're requesting will be provided.
Your Honor, I'm not conflating that stipulation. The court still, pursuant to Rule 26, may place limitations on the scope of discovery. We would argue here that the district court improperly enacted a protective order without having sufficient basis to do so, to say that discovery not be had whatsoever. But to answer your question, could you just repeat the crux of your question one more time?
Well, my question went toward your argument about your entitlement to discovery and from where in the record and from what legal basis does that arise? And it seemed to me like you were connecting that with the joint discovery plan.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification again. That connection is made by the signed joint discovery plan of the parties. That specific agreement not only stipulated a timeline, which was April 30th, for the close of discovery, it stipulated the exact discovery devices that were to be used, which included interrogatories and requests for production of documents. It wasn't until an untimely objection from Ms. Hahn arised saying that we never agreed to discovery prior to the issuance of the writ. It is improper, which is a separate conversation I can delve into. But it was a signed agreement of the parties to proceed with discovery via those methods. I would articulate that the blanket preclusion of this discovery was improper under a protective order that was issued by the district court. Let me back up to answer the question of entitlement, because I just want to hammer home that point and be clear. The rules of civil procedure entitle a party to the discovery of relevant information proportional to the needs of the case, so long as there is not a limitation that exists on it. Those limitations are governed by the terms of the protective order under Rule 26.03 for protective orders. There is nothing in the factual record established by the district court nor the respondents that show annoyance, embarrassment, oppression, undue burden, or expense. These are township records. A RUD construction invoice, documents from the Minnesota Association of Townships providing legal counsel, documents relating to township trees and town road right-of-ways. These were all discoverable, and they never were considered by the court, and we were never able to put on our showing at a show cause hearing using this evidence.
Counsel, is part of the problem the decision to seek mandamus, which is an extraordinary remedy for the very documents that you also wanted to motion to compel, which is the very issue in the protective order, because it's a circular. The end result, and the judge had the answers to interrogatories and the information that we gave everything that we have, and we don't have anything else that I've kept. So it all became a single issue. So it had to be a protective order. It didn't until there was analysis by the district court of whether mandamus is appropriate at all. Because if it's not appropriate, then you don't get this discovery because it's all the same issue.
I appreciate that question, Your Honor, and I think I can provide some clarification. So there is no authority in Rule 26 to outright preclude discovery because information is relevant. That's what the district court held. We are seeking to compel these documents to go back into the town hall, which for the town clerk is required under 367.11 of Minnesota statutes.
Part of the reason I'm asking is you had a legal remedy, an alternative, such as a declaratory judgment, perhaps an injunction action, which is also equitable. But the point being is then you might have what we describe as a more normal discovery period. But when you're seeking mandamus, it was all the same thing. The items that you wanted to compel are the items you felt was by mandamus needed to be provided. And
yep.
So that's why the court had to analyze mandamus, did it not, before answering, and that's why it granted the protective order.
2 points of clarification with respect to discovery. The first of which is the discovery that is requested being the same as the mandamus action does not mean the outcomes are the same. So the issuance of a peremptory writ of mandamus is what entitles a party to relief. That means those documents come back into the town hall. Discovery can have reasonable limitations placed by the court underneath the 2604 scope and limitations analysis. That limitation could be we get to view the documents for purposes of litigation, which is actually what we offered to the district court But the baseline question before you get to can we limit discovery is there an entitlement to discovery? And there are for two reasons. First, because the information is highly relevant. And second, because there is a joint discovery plan that entitles appellant to discovery. We agreed to the discovery devices. They can object to it. We can evaluate those objections. But to outright say, well, these are the same documents, all it means, Your Honor, is that they are relevant. It doesn't lead to the same outcome. It doesn't keep the documents in the town hall. So all of the future supervisors or clerk of the township can view those documents for their records. That is distinct.
Can I ask you a question to follow up on Judge Sleeter's question? Why was there no other adequate legal remedy?
Excellent question.
When, as Judge Sleeter pointed out, perhaps you could have filed a declaratory judgment action or sought an injunction.
That is the third prong of the Chanhassen chiropractic standing test. So I would remind you that in doing this analysis, you should apply the notice pleading standard. Here, the reason why there is no alternative legal remedy, if this is a document, you say, this is a township record. I declare this under declaratory judgment. That doesn't compel an individual to turn it over, and why mandamus is unique for...
But an injunction.
How would it, I don't see how an injunction saying you must stop this action compels an act to turn it over. Mandamus case law demonstrates this is clear with judicial stamps of stamping a document, returning a key to a locked room. This is just that. It is a document. We have no other means to access other than a court order saying you must take these documents and return them to the township pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 367.01, 1517 subdivision 3. So, ultimately here, one last thing I would like to address before the court is the idea of the scope of a record. That's going to be incredibly important in your decision. I think the district court completely got this wrong. A record has a synonymous meaning across the record retention statutes, and any interpretation that says that a record is discretionary is improper, as it creates dual and inconsistent legal obligations for town officers. There was no alternative definition advanced by a respondent, which Lye says it means it's an unambiguous definition of record. And I would also encourage the court to consider the motion that was raised with respect to surreply briefing. I just wanted to bring that back to the court's attention again. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I appreciate it.
Ms. Hahn, you have 10 minutes.
I need an eye. I have bad vision. Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. I'm Mary Hahn, and I am here on behalf of Linus Langer. Mr. Langer was the clerk. I have 10 minutes, so I'm going to jump in on the substantive piece. I can tell by the court's questions this morning that you all have the same concerns I have had for the past 2 years. So I want to just focus right in on substance, because in order to compel mandamus, we have to have a clear legal right, clearly. So there is this, we have to look at the statutes. And the township, the statute it relied on in its petition was 367.01. It uses the term records, but there's no definition of records. Therefore, the township then broadens its search. What other definitions of records can we find to try to hook on our mandamus demand? And I want to point out to the court that these other statutes contain discretionary language within them. Let me, and this is touched on in Minnesota Statute 1517. That's one of the statutes that the township relies on. That is called official records. What must be kept. And it says officers and agencies shall make and preserve all records necessary to a full and accurate knowledge of their official activities. That is in 15.17 subdivision 1. That is discretionary language inherent in it. There is a third statute that the township points to, And the township is saying this is sort of a nebulous statutory framework that warrants mandamus. And that is 138.17. And this has to do with destruction and preservation of records. And it particularly pertains to the Minnesota Historical Society. But even that statute, which if we go to subpart B, for purposes of this chapter, subpart B4, the term records excludes data and information that does not become part of an official transaction. So those three statutes are what the township wants this court to put together to issue the extraordinary remedy of mandamus. And that will not work. It is not clear. I want to touch on this case, Your Honor's question about the township not even asking, not taking that next step to actually secure the alternative writ. It never happened. At what point did the tipping point happen? We brought our motion for summary judgment 10 months after the petition. All of this time frame, the township is doing nothing but waving their sword about discovery. And I want to make the point how many times Mr. Langer raised his objections, starting in his very first answer, asserting 18 affirmative defenses, one of which is you, township, have failed to comply with the statutory requirements of mandamus. So I wanted to start with the substance because I know my time is short. The issue of the township seeks to assign blame, if you will. If you read the briefs collectively, there is definitely an assignation, attempt to assign blame. It's either to the district court or to Mr. Langer. And here I want to talk about the burden on a petitioner. And this is in Mr. Langer's brief at page 24.
Can I ask you a question before you go on?
Of course.
To your colleague on the other side's point about notice pleading,
yeah.
Why shouldn't we read the petition where the petition asserts that the failure of Defendant Langer to provide plaintiff with the records in his possession continues to hamper the township in conducting its day-to-day business because it lacks record on many zoning issues, contract issues, much of the day-to-day business that the township has conducted over the past 9 years. Why shouldn't we, through the lens of notice pleading, view that as going to, for example, under 1517, subdivision 1, the point you made earlier, that that's records necessary to full and accurate knowledge of official duties?
The township uses the concept of notice pleading in its briefs as if this were a normal civil litigation action. It's not. It's mandamus. It's extraordinary. So the petition, get back to the procedural posture. The township needed to go that extra step to seek the writ that would have allowed us to all come before the court on that show cause hearing. That never happened. Mr. Langer was never afforded that opportunity. So I would say this notice pleading concept is almost a red herring because they never went to the next step.
What about his argument that you weren't entitled to move for summary judgment until the writ issued? Do you read Lye v. Harpstead in the same way as he does?
Absolutely not. Thank you for that question. At summary judgment, it can be brought at any time, and the remedy of the party opposing summary judgment is to seek additional time. That remedy is included in the rules of civil procedure if they think additional discovery is necessary. The township had that remedy. It didn't raise it. That was waived, so that's a procedural waiver. But in addition to that, again, I stand with, at what point does the township, there is a tipping point after 10 months. How long should Mr. Langer wait for the township to get its act together and try to have a show cause hearing while simultaneously serving copious, voluminous discovery demands, which are in the record, and Mr. Langer did respond. This was not a case of just ignoring it. Oh, we responded and set forth, again, a narrative of all of the ways that the township has failed procedurally and that they were seeking the exact same documents. They were seeking to compel by mandamus. I hope that answered.
So you don't read Livy Harpstead as precluding, as a procedural matter, a motion for summary judgment before the writ has been issued?
No, it doesn't even talk about that. It's silent on that piece. Livy Harpstead, I think, is relevant. The reason I cited it is it confirms that a writ acts like a summons in a civil case. And then discovery can progress in a civil case. We don't get to do discovery before the case is commenced. And that is exactly the analogous situation of what the township is trying to do here. We have filed a notice of related appeal that I just want to touch on extremely briefly. And that is because the district court reached the merits of the case, and Your Honor raised a point, how would it be different if he had gotten a writ and then we moved for summary judgment? Because it's important to reiterate that the court ruled on both procedural grounds and substantive grounds. And that is very clear in the court order. Even if the township had followed the correct procedure, they are seeking to compel a discretionary act.
Counsel, did the party submit proposed orders?
Yes.
And so did the proposed orders have without prejudice?
No, mine didn't. Mine had with prejudice.
What I was getting at, do you think in part the district court was thinking of the procedural part of its ruling and not the substantive?
I don't know, but it was what struck me when I got the court's order. Of course, I was very happy, but the very last sentence that said dismissed without prejudice, I think struck all of us as odd because the court reached the merits. And I cite the Pond Hollow case in our brief at page 33, because that is right on point to that particular issue. So what we're asking, I'm going to try to wrap up, what we're asking, just to be clear, is we are asking the court to affirm the order granting summary judgment in all respects, with the exception of a remand to have it entered with prejudice. And that is based on Pond Hollow. And related to that, I just want to say this before my time is up, if I may finish my sentence.
Go ahead.
The fact that there are alternative remedies, yes, there were. That is clear as day. And lastly, we asked for a remand just on the issue of attorney's fees in connection with the discovery order, because a court shall award expenses and attorney's fees unless certain findings are included, and the court, it was silent. There were no findings on that. So under Rule 37.01, we are respectfully asking for a remand to hit the issue of attorney's fees arising just out of the discovery orders.
I have one question. So on the issue of adequate legal remedy,
yes,
I just wondered if you could briefly just respond to the argument your colleague on the other side made about why declaratory judgment and injunctive relief would not have been an adequate legal remedy when the request is to return documents.
Respectfully, the argument made no sense because, as Your Honor stated, what about the concept of injunction? And a court order is a court order. So mandamus is not the remedy that is necessary in this case. So if there was an injunction order telling someone to do something, that's it. So thank you. Thank you for allowing me a bit extra time.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Ludischer, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, I got 5 minutes, so I'm going to go fast. No writ of mandamus was ever requested. And the court said that even if one had been requested, the court wouldn't have granted it. So even though the township failed to do what they're supposed to do, even if they had done it correctly, the judge wouldn't have granted it. And she says that. But in spite of that, she goes on to say that Mr. Gregory, I'm going to call him, just to keep it clear for the record, people who are listening here, I represent Gregory Langer. Oh, I didn't say that. David Ludischer.
Thank you, guys.
Sorry about that. That Gregory Langer answered the complaint that requested the records. There's no proof that he has the records. He says he didn't have any records. The township doesn't know what records they're missing. And he says he doesn't have it. That even if the court had issued the writ, it could not extend the writ to require a search to look for something that it doesn't know existed. So the township has to allege what it's missing, that he possesses it, and that he has a duty to turn it over. Lastly, the court found that in equity, the township can't provide evidence that it's missing a record that it needs to conduct business. But the judge covered almost everything. And that's why in my brief, I relied almost exclusively on the judge's order. We don't need to go be looking at a lot of case law, because this isn't case law. This is equity. What's fair? They're claiming he has a record. He says he doesn't have it. They don't know what's missing, but they think he might have it. Excuse me. I should slow down.
Can I ask you a question? You're arguing that your client should have been granted attorney's fees with regard to the denial of the motion to compel as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
So where in the record did your client request attorney's fees for the denial of the motion to compel?
I don't know.
I mean, the reason why I ask is that if you didn't move for attorney's fees and didn't make the request, I'm wondering what basis we have to order a remand for your client to be considered for an attorney's fees award, or to at least the parties to have an opportunity to respond.
Well, I do think it's appropriate for this court to remand it in equity. The judge denied the request for attorney's fees, so the judge took it into consideration. The township doesn't really have a basis to appeal. They lost like three or four different ways at the district court, and now they're coming in saying, we didn't follow the rules with regard to mandamus, and we can't do anything until one's issued. The judge, we wouldn't have given you one anyhow if you'd come in, township. And moreover, it's alleged that he was a public official at the time, and he didn't turn over the public official records. So the township is using taxpayer money to fund its litigation against a private individual. It's only fair in equity that if he prevails, that he gets attorney's fees paid for too. Otherwise, what's to stop the township from doing this over and over again to other people? I understand that the citizens are going to have to pay for that. Citizens have to pay for counsel, you know, to raise this. But it's a citizen's problem too, and they need to treat all the citizens fairly. I'd also like to raise the issue that the judge didn't talk about, is these aren't township records. The statute says records of the office. Records of the office. What is the township doing here? The records belong to David Roll, who was the successor. Any records that he might have our records that David Roll should be here saying, I didn't get for my office. There's no evidence of that. Time is up.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll start just with two overarching arguments and then kind of address the arguments as they were presented. The two overarching arguments start first with the notice pleading standard. This is woefully undercovered by respondent and not addressed. This is a very low standard, and it brings me to the second part of this overarching analysis, which is Ms. Hahn keeps saying mandamus is extraordinary and tries to say that there should be a heightened standard that applies. There is a distinction between an alternative writ and a peremptory writ. The peremptory writ is what entitles a petitioner to relief. It is at the show cause hearing when the evidence is presented that this heightened standard applies because it entitles someone to relief. To secure an alternative writ and to, as McFarland and Keppel says, proceed with the evidence, you only need the notice pleading standard. So, do the broad brush allegations in the petitions entitle the petitioner to relief? The answer is yes. Is there any case law that says we needed to motion or do anything different other than the face of the petition requesting the relief, us telling the district court in response to the summary judgment motion, not only is this premature, we're asking you to issue the writ because it is how we move through this case. We can't serve it like a summons, like Ms. Hahn says, until the court orders us to do so. We can't make a show cause hearing. Only the court can order that. And that low threshold notice pleading standard is what applies. We are entitled to the issuance of an alternative writ and are seeking remand with an order to issue the alternative writ and have discovery follow if this court does not grant our motion to compel.
Excuse me, do you agree that, in the petition, under that notice pleading standard, do you need to make a showing that there is no other adequate remedy?
Yes, I would agree that that is the third prong of the mandamus action. I will point the court, though, to one other thing. It is not just the face of the petition that needs to be considered. This is in my district court briefing. It says that the court can consider information outside of the scope of the writ if it's obtained prior to its determination on the writ. The district court would have had my argument prior to making its determination on summary judgment that the writ should have issued based upon the allegations and my arguments that there's no other form of relief like declaratory judgment that would be appropriate.
Why not injunctive relief in the way that, I mean, you seem to narrowly construe what an injunction can be, just to ordering a party to stop doing something rather than to commanding a party to do something.
Your Honor, respectfully, the first argument I would say is there is no argument that injunctive relief is a proper remedy here or that it would entitle appellant to the same thing. There's nothing from either respondent in the record with respect to that.
Isn't that burden on you? I mean, you're the one trying to make the case for the issuance of the writ. And
yes,
it's a component of the standard that you show there's no other adequate legal remedy, then isn't it your burden to show that injunctive relief would not be appropriate?
Understood, and I'm happy to answer that component of the question as well. The answer there is that the Lengers, upon a request from a former public official, did not turn over the documents. Upon discovery requests, did not turn over the documents. And so even a court order saying turn over the documents wouldn't work through an injunction. Mandamus is meant literally for cases like this. It is to compel the turning over of a document. Why would a respondent listen to an injunction or listen to mandamus but not listen to an injunction? Sanctioning would be the same result to each. This is what mandamus actions are for, compelling a public official to do something that they have not. And an injunction here isn't a remedy that's ever explained, articulated. It's not in the district court order. The district court doesn't make findings that there are alternative remedies. And so this is an inquiry that, quite frankly, is not a noticed issue for appeal, and declaratory judgment and injunctive relief would not be appropriate. I would like to touch just briefly on the idea of records. Ms. Hahn tries to say that these are all disconnected statutes. They're a unified scheme. 1517 says keep all records. 138.17 says you're exempt from that. It's an exception to the rule. If you create a record retention policy, this court said, we don't have that policy. So 1517, default rule, keep all records is in place. Respondent Linus Langer said he has all records. Respondent Gregory Langer said, I didn't delete all records used to aid me in the transaction of public business. Those are all township records. If this is a case of equity, Rudd construction invoice, emails from Minnesota Association of Township, documents related to right-of-way.
The statute doesn't define what a record is.
It does under 138.17, Your Honor. It's a document made or received by a public official in the transaction of public business, a paid construction invoice.
But in 367.1...
Correct. It is unambiguous. And if I may just have a moment to address this, the Lye case says when you're doing a statutory interpretation, if something's not clearly defined, if a party advances an interpretation based in the plain language of the law, which 138.17 is, that interpretation will stand if there's no alternative definition in the plain language of the law. The district court's analysis turned on printing of records. 138.17 cuts directly against that. It says, regardless of the physical form or characteristics, a document or material is a record, whether it's printed or not. So there's no alternative record here. It creates dual and inconsistent interpretations to say, record's discretionary, can be whatever you want, 367.01, but he's bound by 1517 subdivision 3 to turn those records over, and that's defined by the statutory harmony of 1517 and 138.17. I think that you can't create inconsistent interpretations, and even if this were ambiguous, which I don't believe it is because there's no alternative definition advanced, think about the legislative intent here. It's pretty clear that a government record is meant to be a government record. It doesn't need to be defined in each statute. The Records Retention Act is referring to the same records that our townships deal with.
Thank you, counsel. Unless there's further questions, your time has expired. Thank you to both sets of counsel for your helpful briefing and arguments. This case has been submitted. We'll issue our decision within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.